From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now, and an empty chair made news today on Capitol Hill. Attorney General William Barr refused to testify before the House Judiciary Committee, where he was scheduled to answer questions about the special counsel's Russia investigation. Barr took issue with the Democrats' plan to have a staff lawyer conduct some of the questioning. The Democratic chairman, Gerald Nadler, left an open seat for the attorney general and then convened the hearing anyway.
History will judge us for how we face this challenge. We will all be held accountable in one way or the other. And if he does not provide this committee with the information it demands and the respect it deserves, Mr. Barr's moment of accountability will come soon enough.
The hearing lasted all of 20 minutes, a far cry from Barr's marathon yesterday before a Republican-led Senate committee. Joining us now is Julian Zelizer. He's professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. And Julian, this was really something of a spectacle today. There was the empty chair. Then one Democrat brought a plastic chicken to the hearing, essentially mocking the attorney general. What did you see today?
Yeah, once you're in the prop stage of congressional politics, you know things are getting serious. I think, you know, those were moments that reflect the growing frustration a lot of Democrats have. They're watching what the attorney general has done, how the president's responding to the congressional part of this investigation. And I think a lot of them are frustrated about what to do, and they're not sure politically what steps they want to take, and they're not even sure in terms of their authority what they can compel this administration to do in helping them. And so that's what you're seeing play out today.
Democrats are frustrated, but so are Republicans. After Nadler spoke this morning, the ranking Republican on the committee had a turn. Here's Georgia Republican Doug Collins.
Take whatever you want to take. You can go out and have press conferences. You can say it from this dais. You can say whatever you want to have. But the reason Bill Barr is not here today is because the Democrats decided they didn't want him here today. That's the reason he's not here.
And actually, you know, the real fight, Julian, here isn't necessarily over this empty chair. It's about the Democrats' demand that Barr produce a fully unredacted version of the Mueller report. And it's for that reason that we could actually see contempt proceedings filed by the Democrats against Barr, which is not unheard of in American politics, but a big step.
Right. So, you know, I think the Republican argument here is that the Democrats are going too far. The Democrats in general, I think, are on legitimate grounds in terms of what they're requesting at this point. But this frustration is bubbling up. And we saw this with Eric Holder under President Obama. Ultimately, there was a negotiated end to documents that Republicans then wanted from the attorney general. And you've had these kinds of battles going back to Nixon. I mean, this was one of the main issues with President Nixon, his refusal or reluctance to give over material during investigations. So this is a not common but familiar kind of battle. And I think it gets to the heart of presidential power and congressional oversight.
There was a fear that trying to impeach the president would be a risk for Democrats as they get ready to head into the 2020 election. But what about the attorney general? Does going after Barr with either contempt proceedings or some people are even talking about impeachment, does that carry the same kind of risk or is that a safer bet for them?
I think in some ways it can carry just as much, if not more, risk in that it doesn't get to the heart of the issue. In some ways, the president has thrown Attorney General Barr out there and all the focus is on him. So the Democrats could get wrapped up in a long process either of impeachment or contempt proceedings and not be dealing with the president, not be dealing with the questions of what this administration is willing to do in terms of exercising power and still get all the backlash about continual pursuit of inquiry. So
right.
It might be the worst of both worlds.
Yeah, I don't know if you heard the anger in Nadler's voice. I mean, it is kind of what it heard to me. Just the tone of voice that he was using makes me wonder if Democrats are sort of walking down a path that they're not able to bring themselves back from, you know, like because they're so angry, they can't help it.
Well, I think it's more that President Trump might be pushing them down a path that they didn't actually want to take, meaning every step of the way, they're moving away from impeachment. Speaker Pelosi says we don't want to go there, yet the president keeps forcing their hand and almost testing them to see, are you going to do it? And I think that's part of what you're hearing from Nadler.
So Republicans are saying this whole Mueller investigation is over. The Democrats clearly not ready to move on. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi today even accused Barr of lying to Congress. So the rhetoric is ramping up almost by on a daily basis. Who do you think the American people will ultimately side with here?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the American people have not sided with President Trump only in how we see national approval polls. On the other hand, support at this point for impeachment still remains pretty low. It's a process. You know, it can change if the Democrats go down that route. Public opinion might shift. So I think it's very hard to predict. The public doesn't know a lot of this. They don't even know what's in the report. So in some ways, imagining how they'd respond to this is premature because they haven't seen hearings. They haven't seen all the information. So it's a lot of speculation.
All right. Julian Zell is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
Well, a cruise ship off the Caribbean island of St. Lucia remains under quarantine after someone on board contracted the measles. It's unclear what happens next for the 300 people on the ship. But in the midst of this ongoing global measles outbreak, there have been a lot of questions about who may need a measles booster shot. Joining us now is Dr. William Schaffner, professor at Vanderbilt University Medical Center. Welcome back to Here and Now.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
And I have to say, every time I hear another story about another piece of this measles outbreak, I wonder about all of the people in this country who may have been vaccinated so long ago that they don't even know what the status of their own vaccination is. I have to say, I texted my mom and said, by the way, we were vaccinated for measles, weren't we? And she said, yes, yes, you were. But at what point do kids get vaccinated for this? And how long does the vaccination last?
Well, children start to be vaccinated either at 12 or 15 months of age, and then they get a second dose, usually at age 4, 5, or 6, somewhere in there. Fortunately, the protection from the vaccine is lifelong for 97% of us. So that's really an excellent vaccine.
So there's no booster shot needed as an adult?
There's no booster shot needed for an adult. Now, that said, if you're an adult who was vaccinated before 1989 and you're going to an area of the world where there's ongoing measles transmission, you might want to review your status to make sure you got vaccinated. And if there's any insecurity, just get another dose of MMR to be sure.
Now, there's another piece of this, too, because we just spoke with the director of the CDC last week, Dr. Robert Redfield, who laid out two categories of older adults who may have different immunities to measles. Here he is.
Those of us that were born before 1957 are really assumed to have had wild-type measles and are immune for life. There is a small group that were vaccinated between 1963 and 1967 that may have received a killed vaccine, which is not as efficacious.
Okay, so that confuses things a little bit. Tell us more about what people should know if they were born in those years.
Well, if they were born in those years, they may have received the very first measles vaccine, which, as Dr. Redfield said, was a killed vaccine that turned out not to work very well because its protection waned very rapidly. Many of those people subsequently received the vaccine we're using now, a live vaccine. But if you're a traveler, as I said, to a place where there is measles that's being transmitted internationally, or if you're one of those adults who's living in a current community where there's measles, and there's any kind of insecurity about your measles protection, you can just get a dose of MMR, the measles-containing vaccine. It won't hurt you in either way, and it can provide some peace of mind.
If you have come in contact with someone who has measles, but you yourself are vaccinated, can you pass measles on to a third person?
No, you will not, because your protection will prevent that from happening. So you're not only protecting yourself, you're protecting people around you because you will not be a transmitter.
What do you think needs to happen right now, Dr. Schaffner, to get this measles outbreak under control and make sure that next week and the week after that and the week after that, we're not hearing story after story about a new outbreak somewhere else in the world.
You've just heard me sigh, because every child that is unvaccinated, if they were vaccinated today, this problem would end completely in 2 weeks. The issue really is unvaccinated children. We need to extend the protection of the vaccine to all of those children, and we can once again eliminate measles from the United States.
That is Dr. William Schaffner, a professor at Vanderbilt University Medical Center. Dr. Schaffner, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And it could be years before we hear this again. That's the great organ at Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris being played in 1970 during the funeral of President Charles de Gaulle. We now know that the organ was spared in last month's massive fire at Notre Dame. Also spared, the cathedral's 10 bells, which ring to mark momentous events. Those are just some of the sounds of Notre Dame, where Western music as we know it was born. Let's bring in Mark Foley. He's the principal double bass player in the Wichita Symphony and professor of music theory at Wichita State University. He has put together a Notre Dame playlist for us. Mark, welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, so let's hear some of the music, and we'll start with the bells. The largest is known as Emmanuel, named by King Louis XIV. It is rung on its own for the most solemn of occasions, and then eventually the other bells join in. Tell me about these bells, all of which have their own name, by the way.
Right, yeah. This is just one example of how much structures like this are important to our sonic space. These bells are rung at important times, weddings, coronations, funerals. So people are all around knew something very important was happening.
So those are the bells. Now, what about the organ, which dates back to the 1700s? It was located in the bell tower, which probably actually helped save it, because the tower has this stone roof and it slopes so that the water from the fire hoses didn't actually rain down on it. Here's one of Notre Dame's three organists playing a very famous Bach toccata. One organist says when he plays the instrument in Notre Dame, the stones sing. Your thoughts on this instrument?
Well, this structure comes from a time when everything was big. They had to do everything big. This organ, when it was made, is huge. There's 8,000 pipes. There are 115 ranks or different types of sounds it can make. The longest pipe is 32 feet long. So it's a huge sound. It was created by Aristide Cavalier-Cole, a real innovator in organ design, was able to figure out how to get a lot of air through these pipes. Mm. And so I'd imagine it's the loudest thing that some people could hear in a musical context. I suppose it'd be like going to a Skrillex concert now.
Huh. And what about the acoustics of the building where it's played? That echo is 7 seconds long.
Right. Amazing. I can't compare anything to it. Like, how would you write music for a space like this? It broadens things out, and as we'll hear when we get into the real medieval early repertoire, you're going to hear a lot of echoing that really just kind of amplifies the sound.
Okay, well, let's do it. The cathedral itself is actually 500 years older than the organ. It dates back to the 1200s. And now this is important because this is where music as we know it in the West was born. A style known as polyphony was invented at Notre Dame. And I want to hear a sense of what church music was like before the cathedral. So those are Gregorian chants. Now let's hear some polyphonic music written by a composer from the Notre Dame School of the 12th century. His name was Leonin, and this is his Viderunt Omnes. So what's the difference between those two pieces of music?
Yeah, so what's going on is this cathedral was built right as Paris was rising economically, intellectually. It was a cultural center of Europe. And I suppose as a musician, this would be the biggest gig you could get. So if you're a monk doing these Gregorian chants or plain chants, they sometimes call them, they've been doing this for 1,000 years, and they're trying to step up their game here. So what's going on is they are adding melodies together. Polyphony means more than one melody going on at the same time. It's a very scientific, difficult technical thing to do. I suppose people were improvising this sort of thing before, but here we're actually writing it down and getting it so that these things happen at the same time.
Well, let's hear a little bit more as this polyphony evolves. Here's Leonin's successor at Notre Dame, Perrotin. So that's a little bit more complicated than the last example. Do you see, like, traces of that in music today?
Yes, absolutely. What's going on there is those very long, low notes that you were hearing almost in the background are the actual original chant. And then these composers added new melodies on top of them. The hard part of this is that you also have to come up with a rhythmic notation. Otherwise, you'll have a big traffic jam where people wouldn't know when to start and stop singing. So they came up with a real clever way of using poetic feet. This is trochaic, long, short, long, short, long, short, long, short. Is a way of using, of showing what rhythm you would like the singers to sing. And this filters down. This goes through from this Gothic era. I mean, you could call this the original Goth music, I suppose. Through the medieval times into the Renaissance, all the way up to today, Western music is all about these collisions of different melodies.
Well, another piece of music on your list is a big hit from a little bit later, 1364, a 14th century composer named Guillaume de Machaut, and the Kyrie from his Mass for Notre Dame. Why did you pick this piece of music?
Well, first of all, I'm cheating a little bit. This wasn't actually written for the Cathedral of Notre Dame. It was for a cathedral at Reims. But it's called the Mass for Notre Dame. And it's, I think, one of the flowerings of this new style. There are four voices going on at once, four different texts happening at the same time. And this composer, Guillaume de Machaut, was undisputedly the master of this style. A bunch of graduate students studying for their orals came up with a point system, trying to figure out who's the best composer in all of history. Guillaume de Machaut came out on top.
I know you've been thinking about modern music lately in the context of Notre Dame burning, but also in the context of churches that have burned here in the United States recently as well, specifically three recent arsons at black churches in Louisiana. And it's made you think about gospel music. So we're going to bring in Aretha Franklin here singing Mary, Don't You Weep at the Temple Missionary Baptist Church in Los Angeles. This is from 1972. You shed the light. Come on, So we're making quite the musical journey here from the 1200s to 1972. But what's the connection between what we heard from Notre Dame and what Aretha Franklin is doing here?
Right, yeah. These are both cradles of musical culture. In my opinion, all of American music carries the DNA of black gospel music in this area, in southern Louisiana. It comes from New Orleans and went north from there with the Great Migration. I'm talking about country, blues, jazz, rock and roll, soul, R&B, rap. It all comes from this music. And here's Aretha Franklin bringing it all back home for us. This particular piece I chose because it's called Mary, Don't You Weep. Notre Dame, of course, means Our Lady or Mary. So it all ties together with that.
Mark, as these churches in Louisiana and, of course, this grand cathedral in France undertake the task of rebuilding, what role do you think this kind of music will play in the healing process?
I think it's essential. I think music is such a big part of the church services in both these styles, right? And it's what brings people together. Music works on so many levels other than intellectual. It affects your body. It affects your spirit.
That's Mark Foley, a principal double bass player in the Wichita Symphony and professor of music theory at Wichita State University. Mark, thanks very much for picking this music. It was wonderful.
Oh, thank you so much. Glad to be here.
You're listening to Here and Now.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, EmberWave. EmberWave, the revolutionary personal thermostat that is designed to help you feel cooler or warmer at the press of a button. EmberWave can put you in control in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, restaurants, trains, cafes, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018, learn more at EmberWave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. EmberWave. Control your comfort.
WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange is fighting extradition to the United States to face conspiracy charges. Assange is accused of scheming with former Army intelligence officer Chelsea Manning to break a password for a classified Pentagon computer. He was arrested at the Ecuadorian embassy in London last month, where he's been living for years. He sought asylum there in 2012 over fears he would be sent to the U.S. to face charges related to WikiLeaks' publication of classified American military documents. Joining us now is BBC diplomatic correspondent James Landale in London. He was in the courtroom today. James, first of all, what was the mood like in that room? Assange was not there. He appeared on video.
Yeah, he was on video link from his prison in Belmarsh. He was wearing jeans, a grey T-shirt, a dark jacket. He sat cross-legged with a notepad following proceedings, didn't say a great deal except for one thing. Well, obviously, he confirmed his name and identity as usual at the beginning. But at one point, the issue of consent came up, which is that when an extradition demand has been made by a country, there always comes a moment when the person who is being sought has the opportunity to surrender themselves voluntarily. That had never actually happened so far in this case. So the judge spoke to Mr. Assange and said, do you want to surrender voluntarily? And he declined this, saying that he would not surrender himself for extradition for what he described as journalism that had won many awards and had protected many people.
So what happens now, now that he is fighting this extradition to the U.S.?
Well, there's lots of procedural stuff. Essentially, the United States has made a provisional warrant for his extradition. The United States authorities now have to come back with a full all dancing warrant. They've got to do that by about mid-June. So that is the next point when the United States actually formally puts its formal proposition, saying this is why it wants Julian Assange to be extradited and these are the charges. Between now and then, there'll be various procedural hearings, but none of any great substance. The first, I think, substantial day when we'll hear proper arguments will be, there'll be a date set for mid-June. And until that time, Mr. Assange remains in prison. The WikiLeaks editor today said that he's being held in pretty tough conditions. He said that he claimed that Mr. Assange was being held in all but solitary confinement. And, was feeling the impact of that. But so essentially what we're waiting for now is the United States to provide its full formal submission for extradition. And then the defense counsel will have to have enough time to look at that details before they can then hammer it out in court.
Does he have supporters that come and gather outside the court for something
like
this?
Oh, yeah. There's a complete caravan that follow him from court hearing to court hearing. This morning, I noticed that they were joined by the so-called Gilets Jaunes, the yellow vest campaigners from France who had crossed the channel to come and join their fellow civil libertarian. And they briefly stopped the traffic on one of the main roads through London that's outside this particular courthouse. They're very vocal. They're very committed. They clog up the courts trying to get in, and they are determined to do what they can to support Mr. Assange. But at the moment, he's facing a long legal battle. This is not one that's going to be resolved quickly.
That is BBC diplomatic correspondent James Landale speaking with us from London. James, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Fraud, scams, and scandals are nothing new, but lately they seem to be all around us. Federal prosecutors are investigating more parents who were involved in the college admissions scandal that actors Felicity Huffman and Lori Loughlin were caught up in. Theranos founder and CEO Elizabeth Holmes is awaiting trial. She is accused of defrauding investors, doctors, and patients. The actor Jussie Smollett may have faked being attacked in Chicago. And then there's the Fyre Festival.
Guests who paid thousands of dollars for the ultimate luxury getaway instead were stranded in waterlogged tents eating soggy cheese sandwiches. Not a model or musical act in sight.
The founder and former CEO of Theranos has been charged by the SEC with fraud for a role.
Prosecutors say Smollett paid the Osundaro brothers to pull off the staged attack.
Loughlin and her fashion designer husband are accused of paying $500,000 to guarantee admission for their two daughters into USC. Prosecutors say Huffman paid $15,000 for a professional test taker to take her daughter's SAT.
The lengths people will go. So, what is it about scams that we find so intriguing? Joining us now is Megan Garber, who's a staff writer for The Atlantic. Hi, Megan.
Hi.
And what do you think it is about scams and cheating scandals that we as Americans find so compelling?
I think part of it is, I've been thinking a lot about that question for myself because I have not been able to put down news about
right.
scams. And I do think part of it is that if you kind of look at them in a certain way, there's a level of competence that is required to execute a scam successfully that we don't often see in our everyday lives. You know, it can be kind of compelling to look at the scams and think, how did they actually do that successfully for so long, you know, before they got caught?
Right.
As being a scam.
Like we're trying to figure out how we would do it ourselves if we were doing the same scam?
Not even quite that, although maybe that's part of it. But I think there is kind of a reverse engineering phenomenon that happens. So, for example, for me, I got really obsessed with the story of Theranos, the blood testing company. And I could not stop reading about it. There was a book that came out. I read the book. There was a podcast. I listened to the podcast. There was a documentary. I watched the documentary. There are also going to be two feature films coming up about it.
This is Elizabeth Holmes, by the way, who got away with defrauding investors with big promises for a technology that doesn't exist.
Yes, exactly that. And there are so many dimensions to this story, but I just could not stop with it. And I thought, okay, what is it actually about this particular story that is making me so obsessed? And I think it was the details of how she actually fooled so many people for so long and using largely means that were legal. You know, certainly it was allegedly fraudulent, and she is soon to go to trial for that. But in the meantime, they were using a lot of methods that really were, you know, technically above board. And I think that fusion of what is technically legal and what is technically illegal is really fascinating. And then just looking at the details of how so many people were able to sort of fall under the spell for so long.
Does the fact that these scams seem to happen all the time lessen their effect at all? Are people still shocked by these events?
That's a great question. My answer that I'm a little bit sad to give is I don't think they're shocked anymore. I think we've sort of given over to a little bit of cynicism, frankly, when it comes to these. And we're sort of losing our power to be shocked by them just because they are so common. You sort of take them in with, interest and a little bit of shock, but not really a sense of surprise. At least for me, that's how I often consume them and metabolize them. And you just sort of kind of shrug your shoulders and say, yeah, that tracks. Another one.
You know, the college admissions scandal is an interesting one because it revealed a lot about how unfair the system is. Mm-hmm. Even when everyone else is following the rules, wealthy people in that case seem to have a big advantage over everyone else. Do scams show us something we don't know about how the world works?
I think they very much do. I think with the college admission story in particular, very soon it sort of became a story about that particular scandal, but also about the myths of meritocracy and, all the lies that we're told just about what it means at this moment to be an American living in American culture. And I think that's true for a lot of other scams as well, where they sort of have a resonance within the moment, but they also speak to something much broader and a system that is in so many other ways unjust.
What do we know, Megan, about what drives people to cheat in the first place?
Ooh. I don't know specifically about the literature. I'm sort of racking my brain. What I do know is I think scams in general tend to thrive in times of uncertainty and unrest and social upheaval. So the term con artist, for example, comes from the 19th century when people were urbanizing. And, you suddenly had these cities where there were strangers, kind of rustling up against each other and trying to figure each other out. And, the confidence man arose from that environment to sort of take advantage of the ability of the stranger to sort of take advantage of other people. So, con men comes from that. And I think we're seeing a similar thing now where there is just so much uncertainty in the air right now. And it just feels like a moment that is primed for scams in the broad sense. So I'm not sure about the particular psychology, but I do feel like it makes a lot of sense in its broader context.
Well, and also we only find out about the scam when somebody gets caught. And it brings you back to Bernie Madoff back in 2008. The only reason that scam, his Ponzi scheme, fell apart was because the economy collapsed and all of a sudden there wasn't any money for him to pay all these investors with fake dollars.
That's right. That's right. And you could say that the collapse of the economy is maybe part of a broader scam, part of a different scam. You learn about all these things that have been happening in the government, to make that whole situation come to a head to begin with. And, there comes this question of where does the scam end and the broader kind of systemic rot begin? And I'm not quite sure where to draw that line.
Which recent scandals are you most intrigued by?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I do have to say the Theranos one was very intriguing to me, just because I think it has so much to say about the way business is done in America at this moment. There was so much faith that the people who gave money to Theranos put in this myth, and what is alleged to be a lie. And yet they were willing to devote so many resources that could have gone to other places, to this really seductive idea that Elizabeth Holmes was selling, which was that, people can be empowered over their own health. And that is just, it's a wonderful idea. Who would not want to, give whatever they could to that idea? But it never occurred to them to really question or really say, but how exactly are you going to do this?
Well, it gets to the idea of American idealism, basically. I mean, this is people in Silicon Valley who want to believe that these startups can change the world.
That's right. I think that's right. And of course, I identify with that so much because I would want to believe that as well. But it does sort of offer this indictment of, this is one of the concentrations of power and wealth in this country right now. And, they don't seem to know any better than the rest of us of what the future holds and what is worth our, money and resources and time and attention. I think on that level, it really intrigued me as a story to learn about Theranos because it really felt like this is about all of America at this moment.
You know, when you look back in history at scam artists or con artists, they're kind of in a different class of criminal than a murderer or a burglar. Like they're clever. They're not 100% bad in the memory, even if what they did was obviously wrong.
That's right. I think that's exactly right. They're very good at manipulating other people. They're very good at understanding what someone wants and mm-hmm. giving them what they want to hear. And I think, yes, exactly. On that level, the betrayal, you know, it's not often a physical betrayal, but it's sort of a psychic betrayal, and it's an emotional betrayal. And then on the broader level, it's often a social betrayal. And it just feels like a little bit of a violation of the social order of things, right? Like, what is the most fundamental thing we owe to each other? Well, it's honesty and it's respect. And con artists on that level are violating the fabric of society.
That's Megan Garber, who is a staff writer at The Atlantic. And Megan, thank you for joining us. And we will be sending you all expense paid to the Fyre Festival next year. They have the greatest lunches. I mean, it's like a turkey sandwich in a box. Ooh. And you get to stay in a beautiful tent. Whatever you want.
This sounds wonderful. Yes. Let me know where I sign up. This is perfect.
Thanks, Megan.
Thank you so much.
There's a major story in the world of international track and field unfolding this week, and it's focused on the gold medalist Caster Semenya. The Court of Arbitration for Sport ruled this week that female runners who have unusually high testosterone must take medication to reduce their levels of the male sex hormone if they want to compete in some events. It's a landmark decision that could affect Semenya's ability to defend her Olympic title. She won gold in the 800-meter race in the last two Olympics. And it could also have far-reaching implications for other women in sports. Mike Pesca is here and now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. And Mike, this story brings up so many questions about competition, ethics, fairness. What's your take on it?
It is a fascinating question, although if you're Caster Semenya, you would not find it so fascinating. You would find it unfair. Then again, the unstated non-litigants in the case, but the people who are affected, which is to say every other woman that she might be running against also have a stake. In sports, the whole point is that there is a winner and loser. There is a finish line. There is no way to make a definitive decision without, I guess, bracketing it by saying it is true that this decision is imperfect.
Well, even the court admitted that in this ruling. It said that the rule is discriminatory, but that the discrimination is necessary to preserve the integrity of female athletes. It's an admission that somebody here is going to lose out. What else have we heard about the reasoning behind it?
And that's what the fascinating thing is. It is discriminatory, and we've been told that discrimination is a bad thing. And if you're Caster Semenya or someone who identifies with her or is a fan of hers, it seems terribly unfair. So Caster Semenya has a condition known as hyperandrogenism. And this means, among other things, her body generates more testosterone than a typical woman would. In fact, the amount of testosterone that her body generates is in the low levels of what a male might generate.
But we don't know exactly what her level is, right?
Because we don't know what her level is. We know that she would violate the rule. So she couldn't compete as a woman given the new rule that the Court of Arbitration for Sport was talking about. But here's the complication. Just having a lot of testosterone, that alone does not only guarantee that perhaps correlates, that does correlate to some athletic advantage, but not all and not most. And there are many great athletes, male and female, with totally differing levels of testosterone. And then, putting testosterone aside, there's hemoglobin. There is an analogy to the production of hemoglobin. So there are some famous athletes who have had genetic mutations that affect their hemoglobin so that they're at unbelievable levels, and this allows them to process oxygen at a much higher rate. That's allowed. So a genetic mutation is allowed. What hyperandrogenism isn't a mutation, but that's not allowed.
Okay.
So it might seem like I'm throwing a bunch of complicating reasons, and therefore what the court should say say is, oh, this is all such a mismatch, let her run. But then you have to consider, what about every other female athlete who is at a disadvantage if they aren't producing this testosterone, which does help and which people do take as a performance enhancer to get faster?
I think you make a good point about biological advantage, right? Because reaching the highest level of sports, sure, it's about hard work, but really it is about genetics. Put me up against LeBron James and I will lose every single time, even if I practice for the rest of my life. Do you think that this is, in some ways, a slippery slope to someday saying that, look, if you're too tall, you can't play basketball?
Yeah, if you don't have those flipper feet like Michael Phelps did.
Right.
Yes, it is. I don't think the court is dodging it. But what they're saying is, somewhere along the slope, we have to plant a flag and say, as complicated and imperfect as it is, this side of the flag gets to compete as women and this side doesn't. Because you can imagine a situation where if they just defer to the person's own definition, well, what does that do to women's sports?
Isn't it also odd, Mike, that she will, if she wants to run in the 800 meters, she'll have to take medication to bring her testosterone levels down? Now, this is an era where we are so hyper aware about drugs in sports. And you hear the court is saying, take a drug to perform.
Yeah, it is taking a drug for no other reason but to aid in athletic performance. And the aid would be to get an indicator of a bodily substance down to a point where you're allowed to run in the Olympics. That's an odd thing. That's just odd to get your head around. Like I said, I don't envy the court, and I feel bad for Caster Semenya, but I do think that there are, you know, untold thousands or millions of other potential rivals to her who benefit or at least aren't punished by this decision. You have to take them into account too.
Sure. And the court says this should apply only up to the 800 meters. She could run the 1,500-meter race, although it's not her preferred event. Very interesting.
Michael Phelps could dive, but he doesn't have the right body for that either.
Mike Pesca, Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.